It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios, once again, Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Got a lot to cover this week, and as you have pointed out, there's a lot happening actually around the world. And
we're not hearing about it because there's something coming up next Tuesday. I forget exactly what it is, but people are making a big deal about it.
Anyway,
it's a parade or something. Maybe it was that victory parade that they budgeted for in...
Oh, yeah, the 30 million?
Yeah. I think it's 20 million, so don't exaggerate. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, let's start actually this week with international then and Iraq.
Yeah, while much of our local and national media spent most of the week debating on whether John Kerry had disrespected the troops, more on that later. Actually, on the ground in Iraq this week, we began to see the emergence of a strategy by which Sunni insurgents may decide for the U.S. when the U.S. is going to withdraw, a la from embassy rooftops and the like. It's certainly not that extreme yet, but a number of ominous developments on the ground this week in Iraq that just haven't gotten very much attention. First of all, before we even get to that, there was the New York Times report a couple of days ago that the Bush administration and congressional Republicans, eager to try and jumpstart the search for weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein may have been preparing just before the invasion in 2003, which, you know, any sane person has long concluded never existed. But in order to try and cover their butts around the third anniversary of the invasion last March, they decided to publish on the web, on a website, details from seized documents they'd received of Saddam's pre-1991, that is before the Gulf War, 12 years previous to the invasion, his plans for his nuclear program for Iran. So the documents are in Arabic. They are pretty explicit about how you build a nuclear bomb. And there might have been just maybe other people, even perhaps Arabic-speaking people in other parts of the world who might have taken an interest in that sort of information. This was brought to light when the International Atomic Energy Agency and various European diplomats started complaining to the Bush administration, and somebody leaked word of this to the New York Times, and lo and behold, by the end of the week, the website was down. So let's see if we get this straight. We've launched an incredibly destructive and bankrupting war in Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction that did not exist. We are threatening to attack and engage ourselves in a probably disastrous war against Iran to try and prevent it from having weapons of mass destruction. And at the same time, we're telling everybody how to do it. This administration is just tops itself or bottoms itself or something, really on such a regular basis, it's not even funny anymore. So next Tuesday, just remember this when you vote, and we'll return to this theme during the show. But meantime, actually in Iraq, a number of things happened. Early in the week, Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki, demanded that the U.S. withdraw it, the army and military withdraw its checkpoints that were laying siege to Sadr City and an adjacent neighborhood in Baghdad, and taking, he basically sided with Mukhtar al-Sadr and the Mahdi army over the United States, which has pretty much enraged the Bush administration. But you have to understand that the Iraqi government, such as it exists, really doesn't have much authority outside the green zone. The only way they have any authority at all is by aligning themselves with these militias. That is their base of power. And we're seeing that those alliances are becoming more important in Iraq than the actual presence of the United States as the sectarian violence continues to spiral out of control. How much has it spiraled out of control? Well, a report by Patrick Coburn in the British newspaper The Independent this week is saying that all roads leading out of Baghdad in all directions, east, west, north, and south, have now been cut off by Sunni insurgents. That is to say, Baghdad itself, rather than the failed strategy that we heard a few months ago of where the U.S. and Iraqi armies were going to dig a trench around the Baghdad metropolitan area and have checkpoints leading into the city so as to try and prevent violence from coming into the city. Now we see that Baghdad itself is under siege, and you can't get anywhere else in the country from Baghdad because so much of it is under insurgent control, or in the case of the Kurdish north, the Kurdish Peshmerga. But the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Sunnis are themselves battling in the north. And then different Shia factions are also battling in the south. In Al-Anbar province to the west, which has been the home of Fallujah and Ramadi and a number of other hotspots that have seen a lot of violence over the last 3 years. Report by Inter Press Services the last couple of days saying that basically the U.S. has zero control over that entire province, and their reaction at this point has simply been to start shooting civilians. The civilian casualties there are extremely high, particularly in Fallujah and Ramadi, that electricity and water have been cut off to residents there, and the situation is extremely dire. And of course, you know, most English-speaking, this is getting out in Middle East media, but English-speaking media and Western media dare not leave the green zone, so we're simply not hearing about it. Again, just the actual on-the-ground reality in Iraq right now is that violence is spiraling out of control. The U.S. and the nominal Iraqi government have very little control over what's going on in, you know, all but very small and isolated pockets of the country. Just not a very good situation. In the meantime, we're, you know, debating over things like whether the president ever used the phrase stay the course or whether John Kerry accidentally insulted the troops. The Iraqi government's interior ministry, which has been long accused of running death squads, and since they're responsible for a number of civilian deaths themselves through the Shiite militias and the SCIRI, they tend to undercount civilian deaths, but they do issue a total every month that is useful from a standpoint of comparing relatively from month to month. And they announced already that in October, there was a record number of civilian deaths in Iraq. The UN count should be coming out over the weekend, and that likely will follow suit with the same estimate. Coburn, again, estimates that over 1,000 Iraqi civilians are dying each week just in the Baghdad area alone. We have also the announcement by Bechtel, which is the after Halliburton, the largest of the U.S. contractors in Iraq, that it is pulling out of Iraq because it is, quote-unquote, too dangerous, and a number of other U.S. corporations also followed suit this week. Contractors in Iraq, the U.S. reconstruction effort there is basically at an end. I mean, it functionally has been for some time, but even the companies that have been trying to stay there just to maintain a presence and collect money on their contracts without getting anything done now aren't even trying to maintain a presence anymore. They're just picking up and leaving. The only exceptions to that are the construction going on at the 14 major U.S. bases under construction and the enormous U.S. embassy being built in the heart of the Green Zone. And so we learned this week that the State Department and Pentagon are investigating contractors, particularly a contractor called First Kuwaiti Corp., which is responsible for the building of the U.S. embassy, by far the largest embassy that's ever been built in the history of the world, for using forced imported labor, primarily from South Asia, Filipinos and Indians and Pakistanis and the like. They're engaging in labor trafficking and extensive and severe worker abuse, not just around worker safety, but abuse of medical conditions and just all sorts of nasty stuff. And that is being done literally in the Green Zone, right under the eyes of the State Department and other and the military and other U.S. officials. Very, very discouraging stuff. Meanwhile, also this week, we had a report from the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction that hundreds of thousands of weapons intended for the Iraqi army and police never arrived, or they went to warehouses and then disappeared from the warehouses and have never been tracked. Among those that did arrive, spare parts were never provided, repair manuals were never provided to the Iraqis, and so it's basically been next to useless. this is not the first time that the Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction has issued a critical report of the management of the war. And so as a reward for their fine oversight work, the Congress, in its wisdom, passed, and the president has signed into law in the 2007 Defense Appropriations Bill, defunding for the office. The office will no longer exist as of 2007, just because that annoying oversight gets so in the way. And finally, as things continue to unravel in Iraq, and by, you know, note, Counterspin was mentioning the previous guest just before 8:30 that the Iraq war is the number one issue for many voters in this election season. But please note that the Democrats, by and large, aren't proposing any alternatives for what to do in Iraq. They're just criticizing President Bush, and people are rightly disgusted with the Bush administration. But the Democrats so far, with a few honorable exceptions, aren't saying we should get out now, aren't proposing anything other than, well, we should manage the war more effectively, as though that were possible at this point. The Pentagon is, however, responding to all this. What initiative have they launched this week? They have launched a new 24/7 media war room to try and get out more of the good news of what's happening in Iraq. So here, as a public service, is a sample of some of that good news. Sound of crickets chirping.
All right. And as if that wasn't enough, was there not also an item that came up this week about the rebuild costs for Iraq?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That the Iraqi government was also mentioning, this was in a conference in, I think it was one of the Gulf states, that they were going to need something like $100 billion over the next 4 to 5 years in order to rebuild Iraq. And, of course, that is assuming that the fighting stops tomorrow and there's no further destruction, which nobody in their right mind thinks that's even remotely feasible. But, you know, the cost of trying to rebuild this country is just going to be huge. It's been devastated. And, of course, the human cost has been just beyond measure.
All right. Moving along, Israel and Palestine.
A lot going on there, which, again, also isn't getting much attention. Israel has stepped up its attacks once again on the Gaza Strip, which has been basically under siege since last spring. A number of Palestinians have died in the past few days, several dozen, I believe. Meantime, there is still the political schism going on between Fatah and Abu Mazen, the Fatah leader, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Hamas party. Fatah is being supported by, and this is the old party of the PLO leader, Yasser Arafat, who the United States and Israel used to not be able to stand, in part because he was incredibly corrupt, and so when the Palestinians voted him out, they opted to punish the Palestinians because they voted in Hamas instead. So Fatah is being actively supported now by the United States to the tune of $42 million that they're trying to funnel into Fatah to try and build it up in anticipation of what they hope will be new elections that will be called early to try and resolve the humanitarian and economic crisis that's been triggered by the blockade and siege and economic boycott of the Gaza and West Bank by the United States and Israel, and to a lesser extent the European Union. And then also we had a report that came out Thursday in the Jerusalem Post. When you want Middle East and Israel-Palestine news, it's often better to read the Israeli press because, frankly, there's a much wider range of opinion and there's much better information there than there is in the United States. Well, turns out that President Bush was reported in the Jerusalem Post as telling French President Chirac that, quote, he'd understand if Israel decided to invade or attack Iran to take out its nuclear capability. Well, this makes a certain amount of sense since Bush not only understood when Israel attacked Lebanon last August, he had greenlighted it the previous May. And not only had he greenlighted it for Israel, but he also tried to talk Israeli Prime Minister Olmert into attacking Syria as well. So if Israel does turn around and attack Iran sometime in the coming weeks or months, you can bet that Bush will understand perfectly well because he probably greenlighted it, if not ordered it.
All right, moving along a little closer to home, Oaxaca is in turmoil.
Yeah, we've talked about that before in this program, the occupation that's been going on that started in the Central Plaza in Oaxaca and spread to much of the city over the past 5 months, began with a teacher strike, expanded to include leftists of all stripes and students and indigenous folks, and basically a power struggle over an attempt to oust the governor of Oaxaca and the very corrupt PRI party that's been in power there for several generations. That has turned violent at different points over the past several months, and this past weekend, and this past couple of weeks, actually, it's been violent once more as federal troops started to move into the city. It got a lot of attention over the last weekend as Brad Will, a freelance indie media journalist from New York City, was shot and killed at one of the barricades near the edge of the city. His has been one death of a number that have happened. Finally, last Sunday, federal troops did move in. They've retaken much of the city. The occupation is still going on, but it's no longer located in the central part of the city or the plaza. They're now holed up in the State University in Oaxaca, which there's a law that prevents federal troops from coming onto university grounds. It's supposed to protect freedom of basically freedom of assembly and education, and also was a response to the 1968 massacre of students in Mexico City by federal troops. So the occupation is still holed up there, and there was an attempt by federal troops to retake the university on Thursday that failed, and that standoff continues. So that's something to still keep an eye on in Oaxaca.
All right. And North Korea is looking that it's coming back to negotiate.
Yeah, meeting in Beijing this week between China, the United States, and North Korean diplomats somehow convinced North Korea to come back to the negotiating table with the six-party talks. Japan is still saying that it won't participate unless North Korea renounces its nuclear program before the negotiations begin. That, I thought, was supposed to be the purpose of negotiation. But it is certainly encouraging, particularly since 3 weeks ago when North Korea set off its first nuclear detonation, the United States was saying no way, no how, the time for negotiation was over. So once again, this is the exception to the rule where the Bush administration has badly mismanaged it, but in the end, rather than risk any kind of a confrontation, they've agreed to negotiation, and part of that is because in this case, China holds all the cards. They are the regional power. They have the military power in the region. And don't forget also that the United States really can't do a whole lot militarily without China's permission at this point, because China holds an enormous part of the foreign trade deficit and the budget deficit of the United States. China is basically financing the Bush administration's spending ways right now. And the Bush folks are spending so much money on Iraq. This may be, in fact, why we haven't attacked Iran yet, is because China gets a lot of its oil from Iran, and the U.S. can't afford to attack Iran right now. China probably wouldn't let it. So the United States is losing its ability to do whatever it wants in different parts of the world, again, specifically because the military is stretched too thin and because the Bush administration has spent so much money and has gone so badly into debt. And, countries like China hold all the cards right now.
All right. And speaking of elections, Brazil just had an election.
Yes. And Lula, the president down there, left of center, has been critical of neoliberal trade deals and restructuring some of his country's spending priorities to give more money to the poor in that country. Won a second term with well over 60% of the vote, even after the last year of corruption scandals for his party in Brazil. So once again, with the exception of the stolen election in Mexico, and we'll see what happens with the upcoming election in Nicaragua. But Latin American elections still trending steadily left of center, and the big reason for that is reaction to economic policies and the general disgust with the Bush administration.
All right. Well,
maybe we'll have a general disgust with the Bush administration in an election around here sometime soon too.
We'll see. Moving to national, the federal court cases never seems to be a shortage.
Yeah, well, the Bush administration, it's in the news this morning, is now arguing in a federal court case that prisoners in CIA prisons, or in this case in Guantanamo, who is a veteran of the CIA gulag overseas, do not have the right to reveal, even to their own defense attorneys, the nature of the, quote, aggressive interrogation techniques, unquote, read torture, that they have undergone in order to extract their confessions. Now, you would think that this would be an important part of any court case, particularly if you're trying to, challenge the secret evidence that's being held against you, or you're trying to renounce things that the government claims that you said, but that you claim were said under duress, which, as we all know, they probably were. So you have this Kafkaesque situation where the United States is, after having trumpeted and bragged, the Bush administration, that is, about how these aggressive interrogation techniques are necessary and what they are, and we're going to spell them all out in the Military Commissions Act that just passed, the same one that suspended habeas corpus, now those interrogation techniques are suddenly state secrets of the highest national security level and cannot possibly be revealed, which suggests that they are using interrogation techniques that would be considered torture and that are not covered by the Military Commissions Act. Not to mention that they would be politically unflattering to the Bush administration. And, you know, heaven forbid we can't have any of that in the news now, can we?
Yeah, so in this morning's paper. All right, moving along to Sleaze of the Week.
Yeah, there's never any shortage of this either. I'm not even referring to the campaign television ads that are out, although there is a robust cottage industry and parodies of those ads on YouTube, which I highly recommend. Sleaze of the Week. Well, first of all, no sleaze would be complete without an acknowledgement of Reverend Ted Haggard. one thought about Mr. Haggard, he is the author, and maybe he was tweaking when he did it, but he is the author of a anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment that's on the ballot on Tuesday in Colorado, and he's spent a lot of time railing against homosexuality. While he's on the clock, anyway. And, between Mr. Haggard and Jim West and Mark Foley and some of these other closeted folks who in their public lives have been extremely homophobic, it makes me wonder, if you're like a manly, heterosexual, studly kind of guy, probably not a good idea to be railing about the fags and the queers and the sanctity of marriage and stuff, because people are going to start thinking that, you're kind of obsessed or something. Maybe you should support gay rights and support gay marriage, and that way people will understand that you're really manly and studly and heterosexual, because, if you get freaked out by this stuff, maybe you're hiding something. Anyway, other sleaze of the week. The Interior Department has dropped a claim. This didn't get much attention this week, but it should have, that Chevron systematically underpaid royalties for natural gas in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, that may sound arcane, but it's a decision that could allow energy companies to avoid paying hundreds of millions of dollars in royalties. That basically an administrative decision within the Bush administration that saved energy companies hundreds of millions of dollars. But in case you thought that the Bush administration was even-handed about energy companies and energy policy and the like, Bush has in fact named people to comprise a study on how the U.S. can achieve cleaner energy in the future. The head of that study is a guy named Lee Reynolds, who is the former head of ExxonMobil and now chairs the National Petroleum Council, the two institutions that over the past two decades or so have been and continue to be most vociferous in denying the existence of global warming. And by the way, Senator Frank Lautenberg revealed this week that the inspectors generals of the Commerce Department and NASA are both investigating the Bush administration for suppression of research into global warming. And finally, just to note that Bob Nye, the representative from Ohio, finally resigned from the House late on Friday at the very bottom of the news cycle, 1 month after he pled guilty to corruption charges and collected another $15,000 worth of taxpayer salary in that month or so. Oh, and lastly but not leastly, we had the swift voting of John Kerry all over again for botching a joke on the intelligence of President Bush, which, you know, raises the question of, is it an insult when it's true?
All right, and then locally we just have the election coming up.
Yeah, and just as a reminder, I mean, there are a number of things on the election ballot that are important this time around. The transportation initiatives in King County and the city of Seattle, et cetera. But I would highlight three that you should really talk up with your friends and coworkers and colleagues and such. One is the race between Darcy Berner and Dave Reichert on the east side in the 8th Congressional District. Vote early and often for Darcy Berner. It would be a tremendous help to get Mr. Reichert out of that seat and to pick up that seat for Darcy Berner, who, for a Democratic candidate, is very good, very bright, articulate, and progressive. We also have Susan Owens for the state Supreme Court trying to beat back a challenge from a BIAW-backed Republican named Steve Johnson. And finally, Initiative 933, which would be enormously destructive if it passes. It is leading in current polls. Please vote no on 933. That's the property rights initiative that could cost this state billions of dollars and gut environmental and land use plan zoning planning rules. That is probably the single most important thing on the ballot locally. Vote no on 933.
All right, talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. Its endorsement issue is out and on the web now and floating around town at places where you get free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, the King County Library System. It's also on the web, including the endorsements, at www.eatthestate.org. All of our past issues are there, too, if you want to see how our previous endorsements worked out. We are also in the midst of a fund drive because it is an all-volunteer organization, and we've only done this first time this year, actually, so we can very much use your help to keep publishing the newspaper and keep putting out this kind of information. You can do it via PayPal on the web at eatthestate.org or P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. Volunteers are also always very welcome and useful. And because it is our 10th anniversary, and maybe it'll be a post-election party as well, next Sunday, a week from tomorrow, we are having a 10th anniversary party from 4 to 6 p.m. at Asteroid Cafe in Fremont, 3601 Fremont Avenue North. I believe it's the same building the old Red Apple used to be in. So please come say hi to us, drop by, wish us happy birthday, congratulate us for what hopefully will be a sea change in the American electorate next Tuesday, and do your part to see that can happen.
All right, and that's next Sunday?
We are the November 12th, a week from tomorrow.
At what time?
Oh, 4 to 6 p.m. afternoon.
Very good.
And we'll have hors d'oeuvres there, and then folks can stay for dinner if they want to.